Hello and welcome to another episode of Is This Just Fantasy, the book club where every week two nerds get together to rate, read, and review a fantasy novel for our very spooky October book club. Do I say anything? This is the craziest thing in the world to say, Duncan. Do I say anything before I say I'm your host? Because normally it just soars through it free flow, and it's weird to do it halfway through.
No, you go, fantasy book club, every week two nerds get together to re-rate and review a fantasy novel. I'm your host, Geordie Bailey.
Thank you for walking me through that, Duncan. I am your host, Geordie Bailey.
And I'm here, stoic, traumatised, and always desired by the lady's friend, Duncan Nicol.
That is definitely very true of this particular section of Berserk for some reason. Although, I will appreciate it on my current reread. I'm like, actually, I kind of feel like this is Miura stepping back from this. But I digress. Duncan, it's back to familiar pastures. Every single year, around Halloween, we do this series and we're back again. We are doing Berserk, specifically the halfway point of the, as you were delighted to discover, Millennium Falcon arc. We're doing the second part, Falconia.
That's right. For people reading along, this is specifically covering chapters 236 to 307, or if you're in the white little volume books, volume 27 to 35, or if you're really lucky, you have the big black deluxe editions, content in volume 9 to 12.
Thank you, Duncan, for sharing. Yes, exactly. This is a contentious part of Berserk, Duncan.
Do you know what? I can certainly see that.
As someone who's been a fan of Berserk for a long time, and granted, it's not like I was reading this upon release. I would be way too young for it, because we're going between like 2005 to 2009 in this period. So 4 years of publication, that's a pretty long time. And the chapter releases are getting longer, they're getting further and further apart in this period.
Just to give some context to the chapter releases, because Berserk quite famously takes forever for chapters to come out, and that's before, obviously, the sad death of the original author. But I did kind of have a little note and a little dig into this. So in the first 15 years of Berserk existing, 30 volumes worth of content came out. In the last 15 years, 8 volumes of content has come out. So yeah, things really slowed down.
And there's a lot of factors for that. It got better. Like, it literally got better. It became more beautiful. More time was put into each individual chapter. Miura's work ethic changed such that he was more demanding of himself and his team to create really great work. But there was other stuff at play as well. Miura's health, for example. There was also, like, apparently he was, like, addicted to gacha games for a bit.
Wow. To the extent fair enough. It happens to us all, I guess. But I must say, approaching it now and getting this content in a nice big dump, you know, there's so much Berserk to kind of work your way through. It doesn't feel like there's a sense of loss of continuity. You know, you flick chapter to chapter, and at no point did I go, oh my goodness, there's a real sense that the author's lost track, or all the art style's noticeably changed between these. It's still a very consistent piece of work.
Totally. I mean, I think that as someone who has been a Berserk fan for quite a long time, and I've been reading it as a live publication, you know, month by month, or even year by year. We used to get like 1.5 chapters a year. I feel like I would have really had a lot of pain in my life if I was going a couple of chapters per year, and it was the section where you're exclusively following Griffith.
I know, that is an extended piece of this arc, and I feel like we need to tackle this in kind of the traditional way. So let's give our overall thoughts, Geordie, and then let's break this arc down, because I feel like there's maybe three kind of key pieces to this, which we can kind of work through in order.
I agree.
So overall, how do you feel about this section of Berserk? Biggest on who's read it all?
I don't know. I truly don't know, Duncan. I really don't. I was thinking really hard as I was reading this, like, how do I express how I feel about this arc? Because we made a very deliberate choice 2 years ago, yes? 1.5 years ago?
I think so.
When we did the Tower of the Conviction arc, we very deliberately separated. We said lost children and conviction. Now, technically, it's actually three parts, the Conviction arc. It's lost children, it's the Binding Chain, and then it's the Tower of Conviction. But to us, it was so obvious that, no, there's a very distinct gap between these series, and they should kind of be judged separately. It is certainly the same for this section, because there's the bit with Guts, and there's the bits with Griffith. And I love the bits with Guts. And in fact, I've always really liked this part of the story. And I think I appreciated it more this time than ever. You know, when I was going through, I was really trying to pay more attention to the side characters, to Farnese's extended family, to try and really engage with the politics and what Miura is saying about the continent as it's being invaded by the Kushans. Like, how is he depicting them? You know, we're going to be on their side, so why are all of them so unpleasant? You know, what is he saying about the new world that's going to come around? And I appreciated that more than ever. And I had a very conflicted feeling when it came to the next section, because I hate this section. I really do. And I know a lot of people, a lot of fans of Berserk really like it, and I know why. Because it's full of beautiful art, and it completely changes the story, and it shatters the status quo, and some cool, legitimately cool stuff happens. It's just one problem, which is that you spend your whole time with villains who I have hated since I was a boy. I despise all of these creatures. There's a bit in this section where, like, the dramatic, heroic moment is all of these human warriors coming to the aid of a demon. Specifically the same demon who bit Guts' arm off.
It's incredible. Geordie, I have to say, I really enjoyed this section. I think what this section had going for it, which the last section didn't, is the fact that this section I'd adjusted to the kind of gear change. You know, the last section I brought up quite a lot of times, when we talked about the, what we effectively call at the time, the troll arc, was the fact that we kind of was shifting from this very dark fantasy into a bit more of a traditional high fantasy. Not that prevents it from also being dark, but we're getting a sort of a nice supportive cast of characters. We're coming around Guts, our protagonist, and we was finally transitioning out of what was the original kind of Golden Age arc, which had that biggest gut punch of a horrific ending, and all our favourite side characters were dropping like flies. Now we've built up a team again, and I was like, oh, this feels sort of weird. It almost doesn't feel comparable. I had time to really settle into it now and, like, really go to love these characters. There are still moments, particularly around the character of Farnese, that I'm like, oh my gosh, are you really the same person that I felt so reviled by, like, when you were first introduced? This seems odd, but... And then I thought, well, yeah, you do seem quite far away, but then again, you have gone through a lot. It didn't feel jarring. It only felt odd when I kind of looked where I was and looked where we'd been. And same with you. So, I really liked the stuff with Guts. I liked the fight scenes. I liked the politics.
Yeah.
I liked all where we were going. I'm going to just stop this. There were moments I was like, oh, this seems like a little side questy. And moments where I went, oh, this feels quite like... This feels, once again, I'll get into it later, but this feels quite far from what I traditionally think of as Berserk content. But I was still enjoying myself. In response to your section, I feel quite differently because I adored seeing Griffith so much. I adored seeing this horrifically evil character just... flaunt his propaganda machine, and when everything was clicking into place, and when everyone was falling for his guile and his looks, I was just like, oh, you brilliant bastard, I can't wait for your final downfall. But this is, I loved it. And that very thing, you're right, when everyone's riling together, it's this amazing sort of oxymoron, this dichotomy of feelings where you're like, it's like, you know, the cavalry charge, quickly guys, you must go to the rescue. of the monster that did that. Oh my god, why do I feel this? And the way it's framed, the Mira makes a brilliant decision to frame it like its traditional heroics. I thought it was great.
Exactly.
Sorry.
It's like
10 out of 10.
Exactly. Imagine if you're watching Return of the King, right? Gondor is surrounded. They've been fighting for their lives. And then a great trumpet call goes up over the hill. And they all stare in amazement. The Witch King panics. Oh, of course, at last, help has arrived. It's the Waffen SS.
Yeah, it's the cavalry arrive moments. But for the villains, it was very interesting. There were still weak points. And particularly, I felt I wasn't actually completely taken away by the villain of the arc. I think I had a similar response to a previous villain in the conviction arc, where I kind of felt like, oh, you're just a mini boss, come on now.
But well, he's a pretty big boss, but I hear what you're saying.
Thematically, story wise so this is where we stand. Let's start off this arc. The first bit of this arc, which I think deserves kind of talking about on its own, is shortly after the end of the troll section, our merry band are off together, and there's this little episode that plays out, quite short compared to the rest of the arc, where the characters are heading off to the Elf Island to get help for the character of Kuska, who is still traumatized from her experiences and mentally has progressed because of that. And we get this really interesting section where they kind of stop off, and Geordie, I'm wrapped in this mystery. Because a child appears.
The Moon Child.
The Moon Child. Right. This blue... Because originally I went, oh, it's... Are they doing a bit of a war orphan thing? It's meant to be, you know, look at the trauma, look about, you know, that's... We've had a lot of macro scale horror. Let's get down to a micro scale.
A little boy shows up, completely silent, never says a word, joins in with a group. Kaska's immediately taken with them. They don't know where he's from. And then, after a fight with some crocodile men, he disappears.
So, obviously, the sort of implication by the time we finish this section is this child is magical. He's connected to the other worlds in some way. I have my own theories. I don't know. I want to say I don't know, and I don't know if people even do know. I have some of my own ideas.
I do know who he is. And I will tell you only this, Duncan, I got into many online discussions, not arguments, I'm not calling that because I was wrong. I had my theory, I was dead set in it, I was convinced, and I was absolutely and completely incorrect.
Okay, so, I don't know what's going on. My thing, obviously there's something magical about this child, they're not just a random war orphan, they're coming from another place. I don't know... But because the way they fall into the group is that they're sort of becoming, Kuska takes this child in what very much seems like a surrogate mother role. And I can't tell if this meant to be a more of a literal thing, like this is somehow the spirit of her lost child that we last saw with the whole rebirth thing. Go back, listen to the episode. It's quite convoluted then. Or this is more of a... This is more of an abstract spirit. We've talked about like the belief systems of humans informing sort of the fantastical world. And this is sort of that in like a microcosm. Like Kuska and like has this belief of this child she thought she was going to have. And thus they've kind of manifested in the magical world. People believe in trolls, so trolls exist in the magical world. And then because of the whole dimensional tearing things going on, they can cross over. Kuska or Guts, like, they believe in this idolized child, and thus they have physically manifested.
That is certainly one idea. To go along those similar lines about maternalism, I'll also talk about the particular paternalism of the scene, where this child is not afraid of Guts. There's this very cute scene where it crawls up. I said it like I'm a Victorian. He is a boy. He crawls up Guts's like cape over his back and like is messing with his hair. And Guts is like complaining about this. But when the child falls off and he's going to land on like Guts's knives, he and Kuska both catch the child. And there's commentary from the other characters about like how they almost make this image of a family. And that plays out from beyond, because what we have is, as you've said before, Duncan, Guts recreating his familiar unit. I won't say familial, because that is a little too on the nose. Guts has never had a family. All he has is friends. And now he's making friends again. And he's, because he is the strong leader figure of the group, he naturally falls into the role of father. Miura plays with a lot of Freudian ideas, especially in the latter part of the series, and Guts, as the father figure with a big sword, well, he starts to come into this role. So even though, because as great as this series is, it's still anime, and I do not like the way in which child nudity is depicted in this section, and even though Shirka has like a schoolgirl crush on Guts, the actuality of the relationship is becoming much more father and daughter.
Yes, I really actually enjoyed this, and this develops throughout the arc. But when I look back at Golden Age, you're like, oh yeah, this is the group, this is the gang. Guts and this kind of found family in the Band of the Hawk. I kind of look back and go, actually, there wasn't that much characterization to the side folks, really.
There sure was not.
Not compared to this new gang we've developed. Like, I know Serpico, Farnes, and increasingly Shirka, and it's like so much more. And I'm kind of going, oh, actually, no, it's kind of weird. It's like I read half of Berserk before the rest of the cast got introduced. It's like if the Lord of the Rings, you were just throwing like Frodo and Sam, like the Fellowship didn't form until midway through Two Towers. It's kind of weird.
I mean, the Fellowship doesn't form until the halfway point of the Fellowship of the Ring, but I hear what you're saying.
And I'm going there. And yes, I like the fact that, I know you said you wouldn't go that far, but they are becoming increasingly more of a family unit, particularly when you realise how most of them don't have a family to go back to. This is kind of all they've got, and that's really examined on Farnes as we enter the next section. So... Mm-hmm. Shall we go straight into the next section? The next section was very interesting.
It is very interesting. I would dabble only in one thing, which is that in the last section, the Berserker armor was introduced. And we got to see it once in a great fight. One of the greatest fights maybe in all of fiction. And so we got to show off its stuff. And now at this point, Miura has to start saying, okay, now this is part of the arsenal. So we have to start examining how can it be used. So Guts uses it for the first time. He uses it for the second time here to fight the Makara, one of the coolest monsters ever drawn. I think you'll agree, Duncan. It's so fucking badass.
I really do.
I will say something astoundingly disappointing about the Makara, Duncan. It's taken from... Maybe, I was about to say Hindu mythology, that might not strictly be true, but it's definitely taken from Hindu art, and it is described as like a water-dwelling, like reptile creature with a long snout. And here, that's interpreted as like a ocean elephant, a carnivorous scaled ocean elephant. It's got a trunk, it's got a mouthful of teeth, it's got these big crazy eyes, it's got a huge bulk. It looks so cool. And then an anthropologist had to point something out, which is a water-dwelling reptilian creature with a long snout sounds like a crocodile to me.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Geordie, I'm sorry, but crocodiles are still cool.
They are cool, I agree, but still, it's not as cool as the carnivorous water elephant. He fights a carnivorous water elephant and some crocodile men, and he has to use the berserk armor to fight them, and this ends up threatening the rest of the group. He and Serpico are about to square off again, but luckily Shirka is able to psychically get Guts to stop. But once again, he has imperiled the group by losing control. Okay, so the berserker armor is not to be used recklessly. And we'll throw in one more thing, because this is very early in this section. We actually start to see that it is already having a physical effect on Guts.
We certainly are. Something that's established about this armor is that it doesn't... Obviously, it protects Guts as armor does, but what it mainly does, it just means that he can't feel the pain and he will just keep fighting until he absolutely drops, or he'll fight beyond that point, and then once the fight's over, he is going to he will just collapse.
Okay, that was not actually what I was referring to, Duncan. I wonder whether, as a first-time reader, you maybe have not caught on to this yet.
No, I mean, the armor does seem to have a sort of a will. Is it called the Hound of Darkness?
The Beast of Darkness.
The Beast of Darkness, which is a ambiguous, whether or not it's an external demon or just a manifestation of Guts's inner rage and darkness, it seems to have a very much a separate personality, which is now fully living within the armor. You know, it wants Guts to go over the edge.
That is definitely true. It manifests through the armor, but that is also not what I'm referring to. If you read back through that early section, you might notice something which is never fully stated, but it is strongly implied Guts has lost his sense of taste.
I didn't notice that.
Yeah, it's very subtle. It really is. Like, there's a moment very early, Guts drinks like some soup or some stew, and he pauses, and someone says, like, what's wrong? And he just doesn't say anything. And then, like, later, the Skull Knight says, like, hey, that armor's going to cost you. Many things will start to change. At way later, jumping way ahead, Guts has a, like, dizzy moment where he loses his sight. And obviously, it's a black and white manga, but I think at a certain point it's implied that Guts is losing his sense of color.
That's interesting. That is interesting and terrifying. And
yeah,
I hate the idea that our hero is going to lose the ability to experience the joy that's around him. Although, I'm not going to lie, I would also feel that is very thematically where Berserk is heading. Jumping way ahead, if I had to really give a guess on like an idea of an ending of Berserk, like, Guts, I reckon, is going to win the fight, and whatever happens afterwards, he will not be able to enjoy it. Like, to me, that's just... that will happen. All my chips are down on that one.
It's a wonderful question. All we know about the ending of Berserk is that Kentaro Miura told his best friend, who is now running the manga... I always forget his name, and I feel bad because I actually like him as his own mangaka. I really like Holy Land and Suicide Island and So Say No Tiger, and I think he's genuinely a good creator. Not as good as Miura, but you know, he's been given, he knows what the ending is, and he's working towards it. That's literally what we know about it, and I genuinely can't even imagine what it is. The only thing I know it's not going to be is Guts killing Griffith and getting satisfaction out of it. That's all I know.
So, moving on to the next section. So, our group is continuing onwards to the Elven Island. And to do that, they need a boat. So, we go to a port city. And quite a lot happens here. This is pretty much where the bulk of Guts and his group's adventures occur for this arc. They arrive at this city, and it's very much established that the Kushan army is bearing down on the nations of the Holy Sea.
There's a lot of world building in this section. First of all, the city is called Vritanis, and it's like Italy, you know, it's like, I don't know, 1400s Italy, who can say? Like, some of the architecture is Venetian. There's a bit where you see people on a gondola, but there's also a lot of streets and a lot of like buildings not sinking into the ground. So nebulously, like, early Renaissance Italy.
And this foreign nation, the Kushans, are very much coming over as, I guess, a stand-in for the Ottoman Empire.
Yeah, the aesthetic is of the Ottoman Empire, but it's actually a section, and I'd never noticed this before, when they're in this, the Chamber of the Great Hall of Columns, and the architecture is very beautiful, and Serpico says, like, absentmindedly, this is actually, like, architecture left over from when the Kushans had previously conquered this part of the world. And I'm like, oh, so this is like Arab Spain. Like, that's the remnant of the Arab Empire, not the Ottomans. To be clear, they're just, like, nebulously foreign. Like, you've rightly pointed out a lot of their aesthetic is of the Ottomans, but their emperor is called Ganishka, and a lot of their imagery is Hindu. Daiba in particular is like a total, like, image of a Indian mystic from, like, the, you know, the 19th century.
They're not European Christians of the late medieval period. Thus, they are different.
This is one more thing I noticed this time. Obviously, all of the characters are Catholic. We did this 2 years ago, but yes, they genuinely are, like, in the Catholic Church, except instead of worshipping Jesus, they worship the Hawk of Light. But they are, you know, they have a Pope, they have the Pontiff. They're based around, like, Italy and Spain and stuff, and they are, like, united in Christendom, or the Holy See, which is another way of saying the Vatican. But, this is what I noticed this time. When Roderick shows up, he mentions that, like, yeah, we'll, like, help these guys out, and we worship the same faith, but we're actually of a different denomination. So I think Roderick might be a Luthien.
Again, clearly there's inspiration from the world being pulled into Berserk, but I don't think it's, as a reader, don't tie yourself in knots trying to go, well, if they're implying this, then surely that would be the case.
Yeah, we literally don't know where Casca's from. Like, who knows? Like, you say, like, where is she from? Is she Kushan? Or is she just, like, is she African? We don't know. No one has shown up who's exactly like Casca.
I don't think we're ever really shown a proper map for the kingdoms of Berserk.
That's not a proper map, but we'll get to that later. So, they enter the city of Ritanis, and the first section, even though we said this is like the gut section, it breaks away, and actually, it's not about guts, it's about Shirka. We should go over this quite quickly, because I really like this section, but it's not that impactful towards the rest of the story, and we shouldn't dedicate too much of the episode to it.
And obviously this is because it's Shirka and Isidro, the two children members of the group. This section felt the most Naruto One Piece of any Berserk. It's about these guys going up against, they come across some pirates who are buying slaves, a lot of children slaves. And firstly, these pirates are very much Pirates of the Caribbean, eye patches and hats looking pirates.
Yep.
Basically, there's a whole fight between them. They both sort of have lessons. Shirka has a bit of gaining confidence. Isidro learns a little bit about he's meant to learn a bit about not shouting his mouth off. The most interesting bit, though, is that they team up sort of unknowingly with two representatives of Griffith's group, that being the character of Sophia and Sonia. And another apostle, a demonic human, but only in his human form.
Wait, what are you talking about?
Isn't that right?
Mule?
Is he not demonic? Does he not transform?
No. He's just a guy.
I do apologise. I have besmirched
his
name.
He's much more weirded out by the demon stuff than Sonia is. He's legitimately the most normal guy in the entire army.
I am sorry, I just made an assumption based on his allegiances, and you shouldn't do that in life.
He was in the previous section, but to be honest, no one will be mad at you, Duncan, for forgetting the character of Mule. I was convinced his name was Thomas.
So, what can I really say of this? It's fun, it's quite goofy, but it does have some, like, obviously that darker undertone of, you know, they are freeing people that the Holy See were happy to see sold into slavery on their turf.
Yeah. And there's a section which I actually found myself paying a lot more attention to this time, because I'd forgotten the specifics of it. We discover that in Vritanis, whilst it's not common throughout the rest of the continent, slavery is practiced here, and when the Kushans invaded, the city just executed all of their Kushan slaves. They just said, oh, we can't trust these people, so let's hang them all.
See, it's not becoming, you know, not as dark. I think it just does a better job of, like, hiding it around the edges of the page.
I'd like to ask you a question, Duncan, and I think I asked you this last time as well, but in regards to this section, how did you feel about the character of Sonia?
I actually thought she's quite a cool character. I really like the fact that you've got this sort of perspective of a person who is blinded by their sort of faith in the PR that Griffith is putting down. And I really also like the fact that she's one of the ones that is most sort of kind of open to the new world, the idea of, like, she genuinely thinks she is doing good, and she does the good that she sees, and that Griffith must also be doing good, despite when things get a bit weird. So I think it's a great perspective character on Griffith, and I think it's a really cool to see her as this early convert to Griffith's kind of PR machine.
Yeah, yeah. So previously, up until this reading, I've always detested the character of Sonia. I do not like her. I think she's genuinely, she's weird, she's unsettling. The fact that she is a true devotee of Griffith makes me really dislike her on impulse, because, like, you like something bad, therefore I think you're bad. But to be quite honest, Duncan, this time, for some reason, it was very different. I really liked her this time. I was reading through and I'm like, this is a compelling character. She's actually quite funny in all of the asides, you know, like, she's very happy-go-lucky. So when the fight breaks out and Isidro's fighting with the pirates, she's like cheering him on like she's, you know, like she's watching a sporting match.
It's almost like she doesn't realize what manga series she's in.
I disagree, actually. I feel like the difference is that she knows that there's a narrative going on, and she kind of knows she's inured to it. She's bulletproof. She knows it's coming next. She's literally psychic. So, like, she warns Shirka, like, hey, bad stuff's coming to this city. And later, she, like, helps trick the Pope into supporting Griffith.
Oh, I think she's cool. And I like that idea. She interacts with all these demons because she's just like, I'm fine. You're not going to harm me.
Yeah.
We're all on the same team. Doesn't matter where you got your origins
She's completely fearless. And the thing that I really disliked about her ultimately is the important role she has in the Griffith section, because she's the one who, like, rallies human beings to unite with demonkind. So in that way, she's like, you know, she's like the Joseph Goebbels of Griffith's war department. You know, she's a propagandist. She's tricking people. She's leading them down the wrong path. And, you know, that's obviously despicable. Granted, she's like 11, so...
And granted,
maybe I'm gonna get a tad harsh.
Fully believes what she's putting out there. And what I really find, I just love about that moment, I don't want to get too far ahead, but I really like about that moment is the fact she's going, no, ignore our superficial on the surface differences. We must unite as a one people. And you think, well, that's the right message, isn't it? You're right, we should ignore that, you know, I look like me and you have five heads and more sets of teeth than I can count. We should just be on the same side. And that element, I'm like, yes, good message, twisted to all hell.
Well, I'm going to look forward to this when we discuss the next arc, because we have to have some really interesting discussions about the depiction of Griffith's new world. But let's stay anchored in the present. There's one the whole point of Shirker's section, because a lot of Catherine characters get a section in this part of Berserk, is just like Guts has had to start to acculturate himself to being a part of a group again, Shirker has to do it for the first time. And more than that, being a part of civilization. Sonia jokingly calls her an owl from the woods, which is very cute because she is quite owl-like. And she doesn't belong in cities amongst busy people. It irks her. It's too loud. It's too smelly. There's too many different people. And not more than that, these people are cruel. They're not kind to one another. And yet, through this little mini adventure, she starts to see more and more things she likes. For the first time, she sees like a positive, heroic, kind side to Isidro. And she realizes that as distant and dark and cold as Guts appears, no, he's warming up to the rest of them. He actually cares. And she sees that in this really, really beautiful page where in the distance she spots Guts having followed her and Isidro to the edge of a city where they have the option to walk away, to leave the quest behind. And she sees him not looking out after them, lean against a wall, eyes closed, at peace, just waiting.
And I really like the fact that Shirka now gets this opportunity to have that kind of, do I leave this? Is this the past? And it's nice to see that she commits for herself. At the end of the last arc, there was a lot of, my master's put this upon me, my home's just been destroyed, you know, I'm forced into this adventure. So I thought it was actually really nice to give her agency.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. She's not forced along for the ride. She's not staying because she has nowhere else to go. Sonia offers her somewhere else to go, somewhere where she'd have friends, and which is extremely dark, because if Shirka joined the other side, that would be really bad.
Oh, Guts wouldn't make it through this arc. Guts wouldn't even make it to see Griffith again if Shirka left.
Shirka has a good section. It ends in a really heartwarming way, where they're in a tavern, a bar fight starts, and she realizes that, like, as weird and strange as these people and this city is, she actually can find a place there. And then we maneuver into the next little mini arc, which is sort of the culmination of Farnese's extremely strange character arc.
Yes, let's talk about this, because that's why we're on the podcast. Farnese is a character that, when we're first introduced, is clearly working through some issues.
Oh yeah.
I can't get over the scene where people are being burnt at the stake outside her bedroom window, and her response is to start masturbating to this. Really, really left an impact. Thank you, Mira. Now, what we kind of see here is she is now given an opportunity. She sees the group. She's being a huge help to the group. She's the key one that looks after Cusca, the most important thing in Guts' life, and sort of the thing that's actually driving their quest. Their quest is not to defeat Griffith. Their quest is to help Cusca. So, critical here.
Yeah.
But they need a boat. And Farnese takes it upon herself to go and secure this, because...
because they have no way to get boats. All the boats in Vritanis are being used for the war.
Exactly. So she's like, how can I help? What can I do? And so what she does is she uses her connections. She comes from a very affluent family, the Verdemonts. Gotta say? Vandaminia. Well, I get this pronouncing wrong. Can I also say, I was pronouncing it Shariq.
Close, Duncan. They're Vandaminians. Yeah, we had to figure that out last time. Farnese has like a sort of like neutral fantasy name. Her brothers have the most Italian names I have ever read. I think he just sort of like really went whole hog and he's like, these guys have to appear in like... Actually, sorry, I was about to say, these guys going to appear in like 2 chapters. Unfortunately, that is not true. Her family are Federico. Her mother doesn't have a first name. She's just Lady Vandaminian. Then there's Giorgio Polizano and Magnifico.
What a happy bunch. Now, we've been established in previous arcs that Farnese did not have a good childhood. She was, I would say, neglected is the key element here. And she was seen as an outsider. And kind of by a lot of her family. And Serpico, who is her, unknowing to her, her illegitimate half-brother, sort of became her only confidant in the whole world as her loyal servant. That's the setting going into this. However, Farnese makes a return to her family home and connects with one of her brothers.
Magnifico.
Magnifico. And basically, she kind of gets a deal on the table, which is she will become a pawn in his games by marrying one of his friends. And in return, the other guys get a boat. And what's kind of important here is that Farnese, in the original kind of set of this deal, is like, oh yeah, I will leave the group because that's what's going to get them the boat and that's what matters most. Mm-hmm. What's really kind of heartwarming is the group doesn't agree with this. They get given basically a note by Serpico and they're like, nah mate, we ain't doing that.
I really love the section where... Well, one, you know, like, it's all about Mira sort of demonstrating Farnese's value to the group, because when they leave the group, Serpico and Farnese, the grown-ups are gone. The only people left in the group are Guts, who is obviously Guts. As much as he is the paternal figure of a group, he's not the loving, caring, you know, helping with doing the barbecue dad. He's the, we're going to do as I say and just follow me kind of leader. And the rest of the group are 2 children and 2 very unhelpful elves. And of course, Cusca, who is a liability.
I like the fact there's a scene where, without Farnes, just feeding Casca and washing her becomes mm-hmm. this unimaginable challenge for Shirka.
And beyond that, the food is worse too, because Serpico didn't cook it, and he's the only one who knows how to cook.
I know. I really like just this little peek into the fact that... Also, this gets quite a lot of pages. Like, Mira really spends time establishing that, like, there are all these challenges beyond just fighting that the group have to deal with, and that everyone plays a part. So that was really nice.
And this was a small part of the early troll arc too, was, like, their camp, you know, as they're traveling, forming a unit. Like, these guys have a life together, and you get this, these little snippets of, oh yeah, it's not just battle to battle. These people are on a journey, and they have to depend upon each other's company. There's almost like, if Berserk were coming out in the way which like a shonen anime came out in the early 2000s, there would genuinely be probably two seasons of the show of just the group being in Vritanus, having various adventures, and using the inn as their main base. And like every time it would like catch up to canon, Guts would get out of bed, do an adventure, get sick again, and get back into bed so that the next arc he could seamlessly swap back into canon. I don't know why I just thought of that. That was insane.
No, that's brilliant. Did you know, by the way, that the earlier section where Shirka is dealing with the pirates is the latest chronological event in Berserk to ever get adapted into animation?
That feels wrong.
It's bizarre. So
why did they stop? Wait, why did they stop there?
I actually have no idea. So Berserk obviously had a classic series back in 1997, which was just the Golden Age and a bit of Black Swordsman. Then there was a Golden Age trilogy that came out in the early 10s. And that trilogy of films...
As movies.
Yep. Had a 2-season-long anime TV show follow-up. That TV show was 12 episodes, which was basically the conviction arc. And then 12 episodes, which was half of the Millennium Falcon arc. But it's not half. It's not where we split it. It's sort of they did the troll bit, had 2 episodes to go, so just kind of made them, and then the show got cancelled.
Yeah, Berserk 2017 is genuinely one of the worst anime of all time. Do not watch it.
It is appalling. It's one of those... A lot of people point to the sort of cel-shaded 3D models as like a weak point, and it is bad, but that shouldn't kill a show. Like, I think The Dragon Prince on Netflix and Arcane, particularly more recently on Netflix, completely show that doesn't kill something. It's just broken on such a more fundamental level of editing, of pacing. It is actually bizarre how it messes
up. It's just a cheap cash grab. Like, you know, we don't have much of a budget to make a show, but we have access to a really valuable IP which people are extremely dedicated to and has a profound impact on the world of fantasy as a whole. Let's just farm it out over like a couple of years and not put any money or effort or artistic merit into it. I do not have anything else to say about Berserk 2017. It's very strange that they ended with the pirates, though. That's bizarre. Literally, the ending point for that section is the Berserker armor. Why would you go to the pirates? Duncan, here's a question that's very innocuous, and I will not repeat to you next year. How do you feel about the pirates?
I thought that they were humorous. I thought they were slightly more light and upbeat as like a villain. Particularly compared to what we've been fighting, you know, trolls, demons. But genuinely, I really think they worked in this moment because it showed our sort of powered, scaled down characters, being Isidro and Shirka, having something that they could deal with.
Okay, I won't be a contrarian, but I will just point out the whole point of that section is Shirka is deliberately not doing anything. Like, obviously Shirka could probably just turn them all inside out.
No, okay, sorry, deal with is the wrong words, but it's a scaled down threat that
it's a situation which they have to handle, right? It's rescuing the children. And also, we didn't mention this, but Azan's back.
Yes.
The mustachioed knight.
Oh, yes. kind of, I'm not going to lie, meant very little to me. I think I liked him before, and I barely, he was like, he was sort of there, and then he was there a little bit again, and I was a little bit like, I hope you're going to do something else with him, give him some real characterization, because what's this?
I can't remember how, yeah, you've definitely seen that he's on the boat, but he genuinely yes. ends up on the boat by pure accident, like he's sleeping in the boat they take out to the ship.
Right, back on track though, so the group are going to go to get Farnes and be like, don't go through with this. Farnes is having some of her own developments. Now, something that I really like is her mother, Lady Verdemont. Why did I say it wrong again? I just decided that was how it was pronounced. Geordie, help me out. Lady
Vandermillion.
Vandermillion. I liked Minion. This character. Minion. Vandermillion. I really like this character because I generally, a lot of Farnes is like how she's being ostracized and set apart. It was really interesting seeing her mother come onto the scene and kind of be like, I like your attitude, girl, and I think you've really made something, or, you know, go with your heart, kind of. It was a weird kind of pep talk. I'm like, where were you to stop her being so traumatized previously? Because you've been kind of chill and on the level.
Genuinely, there's a bit in this section where she's just like, my bad, I should have done better, sorry.
It's addressed. I say address. What's the
hand waved?
What's the thing? There's a kind of
hang a lampshade.
Lampshade. That's it. Lampshade is hanged on it. Still though, a bit of fun. But then we get to this kind of big kind of meeting scene. So there's this big kind of party hosted by Furness's father, where they're all going to have a chat about the invasion. And there's also another element, which is Furness's brother is going to be do a big public announcement of Furness's engagement to this chap called Roderick, who seems very throwaway, and I don't think we'll be in it for very long at the time. That's were my thoughts.
Thank you for laying those seeds, because I was really going to ask you your opinion on Roderick as a character being introduced to the series. All the higher-ups are assembled here, and as Guts and Co. are breaking in, they're gate-crashing, they're not the only ones, because a mist starts to descend and more of these strange demonic monsters that attacked the group as they were making their way to the city start to show up. Who are these monsters? Who are they being controlled by? And why are they associated with the Kushans?
So Guts kind of slams into this party just as these creatures attack. These kind of like tiger-like
creatures. Whoa. Duncan, don't you think you're missing something pretty important?
Don't think it was that important.
Okay, well, I think Guts versus Serpico round 3 is pretty important.
These two, I reckon they'll have about 8 more rounds just for lulls in this series. Yes, so Guts shows up to the event and was like, I want to talk to Farnes. And Serpico's like, you're not interrupting. And then they start a fight in this room full of like columns, and it's this great moment where Serpico has this like mental phase like, I will fight Guts here because his massive sword, it will get up against the columns and he won't be able to bring it to bear, and then Guts just smashes through everything in one fell swoop.
I mean that's not quite how it goes, because the whole point is that even though yes, he is smashing through the columns with his superhuman strength and big old sword, once he's smashed through the columns, the sword is slowed down enough that it can't hurt Serpico. So it's not like he didn't predict Guts could do this. He relied upon the fact that he wouldn't be able to kill him whilst they were fighting like this.
Okay, I'll give Serpico a little bit more credit. I really like Serpico. In fact, I actually think in a weird way he doesn't get enough page time in this particular arc.
What? He has some really great moments in this particular section. This might be the end of like really cool shit Serpico gets to do, actually.
Don't say that. But you said that in the last episode how like, and that's the last meaningful contribution Puck will ever make. And I'm like, okay.
I was correct. God, Puck. Fucking hell. Him and Magnifico, man. They have this fight. Guts wins, obviously, because he's very cool. But the whole point of this section is that Serpico is afraid of what will happen if Farnes continues on her journey. Her life has already been imperiled. He now thinks that Guts, because he can't control the Berserk armor, is a threat. Guts, by winning this, he's proven the fact that he has self-control. He didn't access the armor during the fight. And Serpico says that, well, I'm going to leave it up to Lady Farnese. But part of Serpico wants to go back on the quest as well. And you can tell that because when they present him with his sylph cloak again, it flutters back into his arms willingly, like Stormbringer to Elric's hand. And previously, Serpico has thought to himself, the sylph cloak is not a good match for me because these are wild, free spirits. They can do as they please and I'm the opposite. But the sylph cloak evidently doesn't agree. And you start to see this great harmony between Serpico and the sylph cloak after this, where he's fluttering and flying around in much more elaborate and beautiful ways than before.
He certainly seems to have progressed from like, I'm going to take a superhuman jump, to he basically seems to be nearly flying and gliding about the battlefield later on. Really awesome. Big fight coming up.
Very awesome.
But there's a fight in between.
Yes.
So these great beasts, these tiger-like beasts, burst in to the hall where all the heads of the local city-states are gathering to discuss the invasion, and they start slaughtering people. Everyone's panicking, all hope is lost, what could they do? And then Guts walks in, one big swing, he kills the monster, and everyone's like, that guy. And then more monsters pile in, and they're like, oh my gosh. And then Guts is like, I've got this. Some really cool fighting, back and forth. Guts is really on game here. I like the scale of this fight as well. These are big beasts, but Guts is kind of hacking their way through it. And what we kind of see is that these beasts are being controlled by cushions. They're this sort of, I imagine, sort of cushion level priests who are summoning forth these monsters to do the fighting. And it's kind of established, I believe, on Serpico does a little reconnaissance mission, that if you kill off the priests, the beasts go away.
Exactly. So they hunt down this mission. Like, it's all about the team being back together. Like, you get to see everyone strutting their stuff, doing their magic, doing their cool tricks, and Serpico filling his role in the group because he slips away from the main fight and he does the sneaky stuff. He finds the group of wizards and he kills them all. And this is Farnese getting to choose her own destiny. In this moment, she's been fighting independently. She's been looking for her own place. Like, do I return to the world nobility and my family and the Holy See, or do I stick to this bizarre, scary path which I found myself on? And what really works, I think, about this section is not merely that Farnese gets to buck social trends in a way that's very satisfying. Whenever you tell a story about, you know, young women of high birth being trapped by their position, you know, those are fun stories to tell about women breaking free of that. The thing I think really surprised me when I first read it, and evidently, Duncan, I think surprised you, is the character of Roderick.
Roderick. Let's chat about Roderick. Roderick, I completely assumed, was going to be a throwaway posh fop, as so many of nobility are betrayed in Berserk, entitled, idiotic, incompetent, monster chowder. Yet Roderick is just kind of cool and going with things.
He's weirdly cool.
Which, for someone who isn't in some capacity superhuman, it just isn't normally allowed. I don't really know what to say because I really was taken very left field by this character. I was refreshing. I really like it when, you know, the expectations are subverted, not because of what's being set up, but because of the sort of tropes that I was expecting.
Exactly. That's like where he's best friends with Magnifico, Farnese's brother. And Farnese's brother sucks. He is exactly what you expect. He is the, you know, poncy rich boy monster chow, which we've seen so many times throughout Berserk. So when Roderick shows up, you think it's going to be the same thing. And more than that, Roderick is literally a barrier to the adventure. You want to see the group go out and be all together and accomplish their goals. Well, Roderick is the barrier to that because now he's going to get engaged to Farnese and take away from the life of adventure. Well, how is that subverted? Well, he's actually a sailor and he has a ship. So he can just take them on the adventure.
I know. He he's increasingly fun. In fact, let's jump ahead a bit over the next kind of massive fight. There's a scene once we're on the boat, it's still in this arc, where we get Roderick. Actually, they come up against pirates again. The same pirates, in fact.
The same pirates. Oh, Duncan, they're back. That's so weird. They're back. Huh?
What's so cool about this scene, though, is it addresses kind of a key fact that I'd kind of forgotten. They're like, okay, pirates are bearing down on them. What's Guts going to do? What's they going to do? And Roger's just like, you guys with the big heavy swords and the big heavy armour, can you just get below deck, please? You're wounded. This is my battlefield. And Roger does this amazing, you know, broadside, take the wind, bring us about, mm-hmm. get downward, and then the smoke will be in their eyes, and then we'll cut them across.
It's full on hornblower stuff. It's genuine, like, naval tactics with cannons. Remember the cannons are a thing in Berserk? They're really present in this and the next section of the stories.
Which is interesting, because they are present in Berserk, and they're present all... Like, they've been in this world continuously, even in, like, Guts' childhood. Hand. Yeah, he has a cannon hand. He does not fire that enough. In this, I don't think he fires it in this arc, actually.
He does.
The
second Bakara fight.
Oh, okay, fair enough. But also, didn't he used to have like a crossbow?
He doesn't use that anymore.
Yeah, that's long gone. So, this is really cool, and I think it's really nice to just establish that, like, yeah, we've got these badass characters. They don't know how to sail a ship. None of them have been on... none of them are captains, so I can see what Mira was doing. Like, he knew he wanted to take them to sea and have a sea arc. Clearly he was enjoying One Piece, and so he needed a cool character to join the gang. And I wasn't expecting Roderick, and I don't know how much more Roderick we will get, but if Roderick just becomes like another kind of proper member of the group, I'm totally happy with that. In fact, one of my favorite moments with Roderick, which I alluded to in my intro for this episode, is the fact that he gets this lovely little sigh moment when mm-hmm. he sort of appreciates that Farnes is crushing hard on Guts.
Yeah.
And he's just like, oh, why does he have all the ladies after him? It's just this little quiet aside, and I'm like, I feel you. Don't worry,
it's,
Roderick.
Well, I'm glad you brought it up, because the great thing about Roderick, and the thing that makes him really tolerable, even though he is a barrier to a lot of what we want to see happen in the story, it's that he is not insecure. He's extremely confident. And so even though he knows that his fiancé is crushing on another guy, he's like, okay, I'm just going to be chill. I'm just going to be cool about it. I like Farnes. I think she likes me. And I think she'll come to really like me. But she probably won't like it if I get really jealous over the attention she pays to Guts. So I'll just be cool about it. And you know how he refers to Guts throughout his story? He calls him Chief. He's like, hey, boss man.
I know. I love that. It's so much more fun. And it's almost, to be honest, I think this actually weirdly kind of speaks of maybe like his own privilege. Because thus far, he is the least mentally damaged character, I think, that's been introduced in Berserk. Back to the Kushan fight scenes then. So the Kushans are attacking this city. The Kushans, they're not waiting around for the Holy Seed to get all their ducks in a row or their ships in order. They're like, nah, let's just go for them. Let's throw all our magic, all our monsters. Because that's the thing, the Kushan army is being led by an apostle. One that has made a sacrifice to a Baylet and is riding that demon energy. What's kind of interesting about this is this apostle is not getting in line behind Griffith. He is not on side with the God Hand. He took Seraph power, and now he wants to be God Emperor. He ain't listening to the higher plans of the demon order.
So this is a radical change for Berserk, because even when we had demons who were not necessarily in favor of the God Hand, like the Slug Count, they were still cowed by it. They were still afraid of it. This is the only demon who, like Guts, is in open defiance of destiny.
Which is really nice to see, and it certainly elevates him above sort of the other monsters we've fought along the way. And he definitely seems like he's posing kind of a key threat. What's kind of interesting, though, is that unlike in the Conviction arc where... I can't even know his name. Bazrat? The cardinal bloke.
Mozgus.
Moz. Mozgus.
You know, normal names, Duncan. Normal names, like Mozgus.
Mozgus very much was like, you, to Gut, we're going to fight here. What's really interesting about this emperor is that he is not interested in Guts's journey. He's almost like, yep, we're just so happened to cross path. The emperor is on a one-to-one mission to take on Griffith. He wants to defy the God Hand.
He actually offers Guts to join his side.
I know. I really enjoyed that, by the way. I thought, what a great kind of recognition of what this kind of player is. He can recognize, like, oh, this guy's got potential. What use would there be here? Now, he also then, when Guts says, screw you, I'm not all about killing Griffith, I've got other things to deal with. He's like, well, then I will kill you. And I'm like, don't start a fight with Guts. Can you not pick up on his protagonist energy? This is not the decision, mate.
A lot of protagonist energy in this section. Grits literally blocks a lightning bolt.
It's very cool. So this is huge fight scene that kind of plays out then. So everyone's trying to get out of the city. And there's a sort of a mini boss in this character called Damer, which you mentioned earlier.
Diver.
Thank you. You're really hot on doing this for me. I'm just going to keep kind of flowing now.
Sorry.
But eventually the big boss, the Emperor, shows up in his sort of apostle demon form as this giant, literal giant, this storm giant kind of creature over the harbour with these lightning powers. And Guts and Serpico at this point are just like, how are we even going to hit that? What are we going to do? And Guts are getting pushed and pushed and pushed. And this is where we get a really nice kind of moment between Guts and Shirka. This is the only bit that I really want to pinch in on out of this fight, Georgie. Okay. And that is the kind of relationship that Shirka's had in keeping Guts on the right side. Because Guts had been lost to the Berserker armor several times and the Beast of Darkness.
Yep,
perfect. Got it that time. This time, as he's fighting and he's starting to slip away, Shirka ends up doing her kind of mind meld tactic. But it's betrayed as, like, her spirit is literally attached to, like, Guts' back. It's clinging on there. And she's putting a little just guiding like hand onto his cheek. And the Beast of Darkness is trying to take control, but Guts does not lose himself in this fight. He always stays on the right side, just about.
Exactly. So with Shirka's help, Guts can keep his sanity whilst he's in the form. You know, literally, and this is done by accident. She's clinging on to his back because, out of kindness, he's piggyback riding her. And so you know, we see love and attachment is the thing that keeps Guts centered. And it's also the thing that ruins the look of his armor. Because, Duncan, have you noticed how the armor looks really different when Guts is not out of control?
I'm going to sound really basic and say not massively. He doesn't get like the full beast head coming over
That's right.
A helmet.
The two differences is that when Guts goes full berserk mode and he's not being helped out, his helmet is shaped like that of a wolf with red lightning bolts for eyes, and it's cool, but it's also very depersonalized. It's very obviously inhuman. When Shirka's in control and she prevents it, he doesn't get the lower... He has, like, the snout, but he doesn't have the lower jaw. That doesn't come up. So you can still see his, like, mouth. And he has, like, you know, you can see his skin. But the other big difference is that the, like, red eyes, which are on, like, the side of his helmet, you know, very bestial, not forward-facing eyes, sideways-facing eyes, they're gone. And it's just, like, two spectacle holes. And he looks like, you know, Michael Keaton Batman.
I hadn't thought of that comparison, but I definitely see it. It looks like a piece of armor instead of this sort of congratulation. This sort of jello mixture of Guts.
Coagulation? Is that what you're trying to say?
That's not even the right word for this concept. This mixing up of man, beast, monster, and demon. This is a very powerful man in a suit of magical armor. And you keep that distinction. And it's just that great message again, just being kind of, you know, Berserk is so much about this sort of dark themes, this sense of hopelessness, this world where people, the common folk are being continuously slaughtered. If you don't have the strength to pick up the sword, then there is very little hope for you. And I really like the fact that, Guts is stronger because of his found family, because of the bonds that they share. And I'm like, great, I like the message. This is an upbeat sense that we're going for. So, big thumbs up there. And this sort of sense of we're going to work together goes a step further. Because this fight isn't looking good until a helping hand appears. Who rocks up, Geordie?
It's Zod the Immortal! Guts' long-term enemy and rival.
Hell yes. I love Zod increasingly.
He's so cool.
So cool.
So fucking cool. This section is amazing. Genuinely one of the most astounding piece of action art you will find in a manga.
So Zod, as we know, going all the way back to the Golden Age, where I thought, who's this mini-boss? Why is Guts and Griffiths facing off against this guy? He's come out of nowhere. This doesn't relate to the wars between Midland and whoever they were fighting.
Holy shit, is this a fantasy story?
And he comes back, and obviously he's in service to Griffith, and he's here to kind of try and clean up shop a little bit. But once again, Guts lands on his back, and it's like, dude, we need to work together. We can't. This is above us both individually. And I really like that in Zod, because one, this actually is something that gives the Emperor that extra little of, oh, even Zod's like, let's work together today. I'm not sure how I'm feeling.
And so Guts has the magical sword, but he can't reach. Zod can reach, but he can't hurt Ganishka. But together, they do a big loop around at like supersonic speeds. Guts just holds his sword ahead and they blast through the thundercloud and blow it apart like a goddamn nuclear warhead.
Those words must make very little sense without the full imagery. Zod is in his demonic winged form. The Emperor is a giant thundercloud monster. It's so cool, the art for this.
And they're being electrocuted and lightning all around. I've seen so many people do like recolorings and redrawings of this, and you can feel the excitement of artists when they try and tackle this scene. It is so technically impressive. All the details, all the energy, all the movement. It's unrivaled.
They go through, they disperse the Emperor's clouds. The battle is won for today. Zod has this moment of like squaring up to Guts, and he's like, come on, are we going to have our fight now? And I like how this plays up, that Guts stands up to Zod and they have this sort of stare off. And I really like the my interpretation is that Zod's kind of like, no, I want to do this properly. This isn't fair.
Yes, absolutely. Zod has a sense of honor, and this is a really important character-led bit, which is that Guts gets up because he says, if you're here, that means Griffith's nearby. Where is he? And Zod says, like, well, I wasn't going to kill you because right now you're beneath me. But if you're the enemy, acting as the enemy of my master, then I'll rip you apart right now. And the only reason this doesn't come to blow is that Serpico steps in and he repeats to Guts exactly what he said to the Emperor, which is that I couldn't care less about a fight between two monsters. And Guts calms down, Zod flies away, and Guts immediately collapses because he was literally, this is in, I can't remember if it's the official translation or if it's a fan translation, Duncan, maybe you can confirm, but I believe the line Serpico says afterwards is, oh dear, it appears he only got up for the sake of talking trash.
I mean, I'm gonna have a quick look. Unfortunately, the line in my translation is, good grief, he must have stood up just so he could antagonize.
Oh, that's shit. Oh, well.
So, this kind of brings to end Guts' section. The guys pull themselves onto a little rowboat and head out into the harbour to board Roderick's ship. And they're on the boat.
The boat.
And all I can tell you about what I know about Berserk after this is that when they got off the boat, the internet lit up.
Yeah. The characters are on the boat for the entirety of Naruto Shippuden. So the entire second half, like the second three quarters of Naruto take place whilst Guts is on this boat.
The way you say that, like this is like on the other side of the planet, Naruto is just playing out at the same time.
Duncan, the last thing we see in this section, right before Guts gets on the boat, and the boat really is an important transition point because the boat takes Guts away from Griffith, from the world he's known. He's leaving. He's departing. He's literally going into the West. The last thing he sees before he loses consciousness as the rowboat is going out to sea to take him away is a tiny speck on top of the clifftop. And there, watching from afar, is Griffith on horseback. And Guts' response is not to yell, "Griffith!" as he has so many times. Some of the most iconic moments in Berserk is Guts yelling, "Griffith!" He says nothing. He just stares. And then he passes out. Because we've talked a lot about the found family aspect of this section. What we haven't talked about is letting go. Conviction was about redemption. Holy Evil War, that was about finding new people. This section is about letting go. There's this moment, this whole section actually, we looked over this a lot, Guts is seeing little glimpses of his old life. They walk into the city past scores of mercenaries, and Guts explains to Isidro, like, how do mercenary companies work? Like, what's the life of a mercenary like? And people talk about Griffith, and they say, what an amazing mercenary leader he was. And someone, and Isidro even says, like, oh, no, the real hero was the captain of the Hawks Raiders. He was such a badass. He killed like 1,000 people. And Guts doesn't speak up. He doesn't say, yeah, that was me. He doesn't say, yeah, I know Griffith. I know the Band of a Hawk. Someone from Griffith's old life, from Guts's old life, recognizes him and says, I know who you are. And there's this amazing line, which I never really paid attention to before. The guy who has been in the story since the Golden Age, but vanished for a really long time, says to Guts, the Band of a Hawk, do you know where Sir Griffith is currently? And Guts waits. And he says, I don't know. But I wish I... And then he pauses and just says, no. And there's two ways to read that, right? I wish I knew where he was. But the answer is no. I don't know where he is. But the other way is, I don't know, but I wish I... And then he says no to himself. He pushes away his desire to know where Griffith is, his desire to pursue, his desire to get revenge. When he stands up to Zod, he's tempted once again, and his new friends, his family, stands in his way. Makes him see reason. And then he sees Griffith. And he closes his eyes and he goes to sleep.
It's such a key kind of character point for Guts. There's always a part of me, as you say those words, that think, wow, maybe the ending will just be Guts giving Griffith a hug and saying he forgives him. Is that not what we want?
No. I want to see Guts squeeze Griffith's head like the mountain in Game of Thrones. But the reason I brought so much attention to this, Duncan, and I really think is really profound. That moment, and this is, by the way, this is a huge spoiler. So if you don't want to be spoiled about the future of Berserk, if you've only read Berserk up to this point, skip ahead 1 minute. But Duncan, that is the last time in the lifespan of Kentaro Miura that Guts and Griffith see each other.
I mean, that definitely hits harder than finding out that Guts and Puck aren't talking anymore. It only says a lot about the story and the direction it's going. And really makes me think then, is that what this is about? I can't wait to find out how things go with Cusco, because I really want to know when that kind of, if that gets resolved, where does Guts go then?
I may have given you a big spoiler, Duncan, but that is something I will not reveal. Let's talk about Griffith's section.
Let's.
Now, granted, we have spent the entire podcast speaking about the first half.
This probably won't be the halfway point of the episode, though, because although there's a lot happening, I think we've said a lot already. But let's dive into this. So, this section, Geordie, a lot happens.
A lot literally does happen. I checked. This is about 3 years of publication. Ooh. This is 2006 to 2009. 2006 to 2009, Duncan, is just Griffith. Can you imagine? I'm sorry, I got mad.
And I was upset when we had nearly like 2 years of just Sasuke in Naruto. That is crazy. But this is a big section. A lot of time is given to this. So what's this story about? This story, having had all the setup for a little while now of the Kushan Empire and their emperor and their invasion, this section is about Griffith effectively realizing his dream. This is, if this was a Griffith story, you'd think this would be the end. Because
yeah,
this is him doing another cool Band of the Hawk thing. There's a big battle, and Griffith is some clever, bitch. And they're decisive, and they charge in with the cavalry, and they take off the... They get to the leader quickly, and the rest of the army scatters. And you're like, classic Band of the Hawk. There's Griffiths being a clever politician. We mentioned earlier Sonya and her work with the Pontiff, and there's this kind of great standoff scene where Griffith goes to the city that was being besieged, and the Holy See people all come out, and Griffiths is like... Hello, I'm now your lord, or the new lord of Midland. If you're going to hang out here, you're going to obey me. I'm in charge. Basically, I'm going to be the king. And all the lords are like, who is this commoner? By the way, these guys, I'm like, dude, you have seen demons. You've seen towering infernos. You've seen men made out of lightning storms. And you still have an issue with this guy not being of noble birth. Come on.
He's too gay. Get rid of him. Boo.
It is really like, okay, this is ingrained, this is almost silly, but we're going to push through, because Griffiths basically does this wonderful, like, tit for tat. They're like, a commoner can't rule, and he's like, I've got the princess here, we're going to be married. And then someone comes up and he's like, excuse me, but the Holy See would never agree to this. We are all religious here. And then the Pontiff shows up and goes, actually, no, he is the Hawk of Light. He is the new Jesus. We shall all follow him. And everything they say, they're just like, okay, I guess we're following you now.
It's so awful, but it is amazing. It's exactly, you know, it's the perfect mingling of the hero assembling his forces and the villain getting his way. It's depicted in much the same way you would see in a traditionally heroic story. You can imagine something like this happening in, you know, like the Belgariad, like done earnestly. But here it's perverted to the ends of darkness.
So once this kind of goes in order, Griffith then rides off to what was once currently the capital of Midland. And to be honest, there was an element of, oh, we're coming back to these locations. We're coming back to these characters. Something that I did kind of note. Yeah. During the Golden Age, I got kind of a decent sense of Midland with the kingdom, there's the capital, the border war. But when we get into the, like, we return to the Black Swordsman and the conviction, the landmass gets a little bit like, where are we? Is everything this bad? Or the pockets of civilization? I did kind of lose a sense of the world, whereas this is like, okay, we're back in this kingdom. And I don't really know what to strive through this. Basically, the evil emperor is like, I ain't backing down to this. I've got some evil secret magic to use as one last resort.
Yeah, he has like a fault. So the world, we won't get into this because the world building is really well done here, but they have an artificial Baylet. Like, their wizards created a new way to create demons. And in in an extraordinarily fucked up way, which we will not get into, they can birth demon babies which grow up to be perfect soldiers. And this guy is like, "Ugh, my power alone was not enough to defeat the Hawk of Light. So what if I just jumped into my evil Baylet?" And his main wizard's like, "Please do not do that. That is such a bad idea." But Kanishka jumps in. He absorbs all the power of evil, and it turns him into a gigantic tree.
This design is really good in the long shots, and just a bit of a mess for the close-ups. He basically becomes this mountain that walks.
He looks like Yggdrasil.
That is actually a great comparison. And there's this kind of really good point of the fact that once he does this transformation, he kind of loses his sense of self. Also, I like the fact that his little helper guy is like flying around and being like, "Master, but what about your men? What about your empire?" Like, because he's basically transcended being an emperor anymore. He can't rule a land.
Yeah.
There's this actually really nice moment where he's turned into this giant monster and he's looking around going, "Where is everyone else? I am so lonely now," because he can't comprehend any other human anymore. He is beyond that.
My favorite moment by far is he's seeing these gigantic marching footsteps as this like genuinely like 10,000 feet tall monster tree, and he walks through his own army and he looks down and it's just like red flowers are blooming.
Ugh. Really gross, but really kind of poetically awesome. This is like...
He's made of a thousand versions of his own face, by the way.
It's definitely very heavy metal cover. Not that Berserk isn't always kind of that, but this is very much that. And we get that moment we talked about earlier where Griffith's army, humans and demons, join together to fight this thing, and these weird little, like, his face, the emperor's face fall off him as these little monsters or littler monsters, and everyone has to fight them and hold the line, and Griffiths and Zod are like, "We're gonna go up to the top and we're gonna take out this bloke," and they do. They shoot up there, and Geordie, take us through the ending of this arc. What goes down at the top of the god emperor tree mountain thing?
So, I don't want to get stuck into the world building that's going on here, but obviously, Magic and Berserk is all about the sort of the mingling of worlds of ideas and reality as it is. The realm of forms versus the realm of substance, which is us. What the, and what Baylets do is they cause enough of a gap. They bridge enough of these different realms that you can grant wishes. You can say, "I'm about to die, something horrible's happening. I will give the lives of those I love for something, for power, to live, to go on, to create a new world." When this dude takes a bath in like an artificial Baylet, he's absorbed that same power of change, of bridging worlds, and he's sort of made an eclipse. You know, he's his own personal eclipse. And who shows up at these conjunctions of destiny? It's the Skull Knight. He's always there. And because the Skull Knight can see through causality, he knows this moment's going to happen. And he, just as Griffith emerges, having returned to his true form, to Femto, standing there in his black, evil hawk armor, emerging out of space comes the Skull Knight with his sword made of melted Baylets, and he brings his sword down on Griffith. And this is a fantastic twist, because there's no indication the Skull Knight will be here. He emerges, slashes down, and you think, what's happening? Is he gonna... And in this incredible piece of art, we demonstrate that Griffith really does have all of his God Hand powers in the mortal world, because he creates this ribbon of space-time perfectly intersecting the stroke of the Skull Knight's sword, which may be able to kill a God Hand, and just makes it bend around him and slice through Ganishka's evil tree bailet form. And Griffith says, "This is all according to my plan." And then light shines out in this explosion. Well, not even an explosion, like a great shining forth, which cloaks all human beings as luminous bodies and makes them into astral forms, as the realm of the fantastical and the material become one.
And as the great glowing light subsides, this light, by the way, takes over the entire world. Even the guys on the boat, they know this thing is happening. As it subsides, where the capital of Midland once stood is now this beautiful paradise. Falconia, Griffith's new capital. Someone says that this is the great city that was once underneath Midland, raised to the surface. And all throughout the world, we get little panels showing magical beasts, once at the edge of people's imaginations and minds. Things like the trolls that could only punch through to the real world, at intercepts, moments, places where the veil had become weak. That veil is gone completely, and it is all one.
So Griffith has won. He has his kingdom. He is supreme king. He has united disparate people. He has humans and demons and Kushan. Sorry, I say humans. He has like Midlanders and Holy Sea people and Kushans and non-humans like demons serving him. He is victorious. He has exactly what he wanted. And he's bested the Skull Knight. He's used the Skull Knight's own plans against him to bring about his design, because he still stands behind destiny, rewriting its path. And to what end?
We'll find out next time.
Well, will we now? Will we now?
That is the hope. And this closes.
So it's a gigantic change. And you can see why people love it, and you know what? I love it too. Like, I think it's incredible stuff. I hate all of the characters in it. I hate the people who are stupid enough to be duped by this man. I despise the fact, you know, the fact that Griffith gets to have his way. He gets to win. And you know what the great thing is? That I literally just realized this second, Duncan, whilst you were explaining that to me. I had forgotten that someone says it's the old capital race of the earth. Do you know who the old capital belonged to?
No, I think we discussed this in the past, though. I think, is this the Skull Knight's kingdom?
King Gaiseric, the Skull Knight in his mortal life. He tricked the guy to helping him and then stole his goddamn city!
It's quite a dramatic end, and it shows a big shift of what I assume to be the series. To be honest, compared to Conviction, which is very much, that the end of that arc is a big moment for Guts. The end of this arc is a big moment for the world and the world building. On a similar level, to be honest, no, not even more than the Eclipse, because that's still a big Guts moment. This is the biggest moment for the world that the characters are inhabiting. I would love to see how this kind of plays out going forwards. Something that I do find very interesting is the idea that, probably to the world at large, Guts might probably come in and look like the villain, overthrowing
exactly
the paradise.
That is, yes. Duncan, I don't want to reveal too much, but what I desperately want to see in the next section is the character of Sonya looking at the city of Falconia burn, like the fall of Rome, as Guts marches through. I want to see that, because the destruction of Griffith's ambition, I think, is the most apt end, because What Griffith did to the Band of the Hawk, to Guts, to Kaska, it wasn't just for fun. It wasn't just because he was evil. It was to try and do this, to create, to achieve his ambitions. So destroying the ambition, to me, is way more important than destroying the man, or even the thing that he has become.
And I cannot wait to the day when enough Berserk has been released that we actually know if that comes to pass. But to kind of close the curtain on this arc, Geordie, where does it place for you in the listening of Berserk fiction? How do you rank it?
God, how do I rank it? I really like it. I really like it. I think the battle in... I've said it so many times. Vritannis is one of the most incredible battles you'll ever see. We did not give it enough credit. There's so much amazing stuff. There's the typical swordplay stuff of them hacking down hordes of demons. That's cool enough. But, you know, Shirka possesses, like, gives herself up to the spirit of fire and become and creates a rolling wheel of that smashes through hordes of enemies as she tests her very sanity. She then, like, fusion bonds her soul to Guts to help him retain his sanity. The fight with Daiba and Ganishka sees the entire harbor get full of smashed ships, which Guts and Serpico leap between like Super Mario Brothers whilst they dodge lightning bolts. It's so cool. And then there's the Griffith section. I don't really like it that much because I hate him.
Well, I'm just going to say for me, this is the...
I can't rank it.
Fair enough. I will accept that. For me though, Geordie, genuinely, this is the first time I felt that I finally transitioned to the point where I might say I prefer this to Golden Age. I wow. really did fall in love with this newfound family for Guts and Kuska, and it's just so much nicer to hang out with these characters that we've seen come from very different places and be developed. And I'm now like, oh, this is the gang. This is the group of people we're going to go through the story
this
with.
This is the gang, yeah.
It almost feels like this should be a halfway point. I can't believe this would actually be in terms of, you know, chapter count, but who knows?
Who knows indeed? I mean... probably not, but the story's not over yet, and we do not know how long it will take. I have to say one more thing. You did say earlier, Duncan, that there's no, like, map of Berserk. That's not technically true anymore, because when we see the light explosion of the tree bursting, we see a view of the planet from space, like, to demonstrate how gigantic it is. And you read and you go, what the fuck? That's England. You look at it and you're like, that's Europe. Like, I can't see much of it because of the light is opaque. I can't see through, but no, that's England. That's Sicily. This is Europe. This whole thing really has taken place in a European setting. Like, if you can write the epicenter is Wyndham. If you point at the middle, you're like, that's like, you know, Prussia. That's like Eastern Germany. Is Guts Polish?
Well, it certainly does line up with the title of Midland. To be fair, it's in the middle of the continent. So...
And one more thing is that I realised this time, because something that's never made sense to me is that they are fighting... Midland's fighting the Tudors, but there's no, like going across the sea. There's no sea battles in it. So it's like, oh, well, it's not, like, Tudor England. And what I realised is that this time they call it the Tudor Empire. And I'm like, okay, so I reckon... England has conquered France, and that's why they're continuing the Hundred Years' War. The fight for mainland France is still ongoing, except it's this time it's between not England and France, it's England and the Holy Roman Empire.
Okay, that is amazing, and that must explain why they call it the Golden Age, because this is a universe where England won the Hundred Year War. Fair.
That's the real evil that Griffith does. He sided with the French, with the Continentals, Duncan.
I know. Cannot be forgiven. Griffith will not be forgiven, I'm sure, by us. Even if he is one day forgiven by Guts, still doubt it.
That's
we will find out when we next year when we read the next arc of Berserk. I cannot wait. In the meantime, if you have read Berserk and want to tell us our opinions or tell us how wrong our opinions somehow are, the best place, as always, is our Instagram, It's This Fantasy Podcast. Also, you can reach out to us on our Gmail, itsthisfantasypodcast@gmail.com, also on Blue Sky at Just Fantasy. I really want to hear people's thoughts on Berserk. This is such a big series that's gone on and on and on and has changed so much. It's so exciting. But,
yeah,
also really exciting... we've got another horror story coming up. Announced at the end of our last episode on The Woman in Black, we will be reading 13 stories by Jonathan Sims, the author of the Magnus Archives. I've already started it, Geordie. I'm already enjoying it. I cannot wait to discuss it with you when the time comes.
I have not finished chapter one yet. I don't think I'm on chapter one. I'm pretty sure I'm still in the prologue, but I am enjoying the prologue, so there's that.
Geordie, we're nearly at the end. A few more years. That's what the podcast's gotten to last. Just get me up to speed with Berserk. And then we'll find another manga to work our way through.
I don't think that's going to happen. Unless, of course, I'm going to look up this guy's name. Hang on. Oh, of course, Morikoji. Yeah, unless, of course, Morikoji keeps it going for, like, 20 more years. He's like, no. I'm liking this stuff. It's time that Guts gets to do what all of my manga protagonists do, which is learn to make spears out of deer antlers and get a dog for a pet. It happens in all of my series.
Guts does need a dog. I am fully there for it. Let's hope it happens.
Well, he does. I think he needs less of a dog, to be honest. Oh, man. I just remember what's coming up in 2 years' time. Oh, my God. That section's going to be so good. All right. Goodbye.
I've been your host, Duncan Nicol. Till next time.
I've been your host, Ray Bailey. Bye-bye.
Bye.